This episode is sponsored by Hacksoft, your Django development partner beyond code. More on their services later in the show.
Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a video cast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined today by Will Fenton. Hello, Will.
Hey, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And today we've got with us Marlene and Tim, who are coming on to discuss, I don't know, what AI are, new overlords, these kind of things?
Well, let's give them an introduction, Carlton. Can you give them a quick intro?
Okay. So, well, Marlene, you're a senior developer advocate at Microsoft, is that right?
Yeah. I'm happy to introduce myself. Hi, everyone. I don't know if that would be helpful. My name is Marlene. I'm a senior developer advocate, like Carlton said. I currently work at Microsoft. I focus on Python and AI, so I'm on the Python on Azure team. So I'm doing a lot with AI right now. I think most of the Python code I'm writing, including the Django stuff, is AI. So, yeah. That's me. I'm also very involved in the Python community. I was on the board, the PSAF board, for a couple of years. Was one of the co-founders of PyCon Africa, so I love that. So love the Python community, love Django as well. So yeah.
Okay, cool. And Tim, you're at Wharton, right? Wharton Business School.
Yeah. So I'm a principal engineer of the Wharton Research Data Services platform. We actually work with Harvard, Stanford, MIT more than Wharton faculty on my actual job. The platform we run, we have several petabytes of data, of finance data that we store that the business schools across the world come to our platform to do academic research on. So it's a pretty cool job. I mean, I'm lucky that I get to build cool things and work on solving interesting problems. So I still get to write a fair amount of code too, which is pretty nice.
Well, that's the magic trick, right? I mean, how do you manage to stay involved?
Well, we've managed to actually develop sort of a path for our technical folks that doesn't involve becoming a mediocre manager. That's one thing I've never understood about the tech industry fully is so often the career path for your top engineering talent, which has been the rarest, hardest to find talent over the past couple of decades, has been, oh, you want to progress in your career, become a mediocre manager and do what you really don't want to do. So it never
you've
made
had no training yeah. for no experience of.
Yeah.
Well, it's the Peter principle, right? You rise to your level of incompetence and there you stay. That's how I've heard it phrased. Well, I do want to mention, so this came about in part because you both gave excellent talks at DjangoCon US, which Carlton, sorry you weren't at. I think this is a DjangoCon US. Yeah, sure.
Oh, very nice.
And then it was continuing online on LinkedIn. And finally, we're like, you should just come on the show and, you know, because this is about continuing the hallway track for everyone to make it accessible. But broadly speaking, there was discussion about AI. And I know, Carlton, we're not making this an AI podcast, but both of you had slightly different takes on AI. Marlene, you gave a keynote. Tim, you gave a talk that touched upon it. I guess I'll just start with a question, which is, in your day-to-day jobs, how are each of you using AI? You know, not the marketing type, but like actually like day to day, either one of you.
I'm happy to go first. Like Will, you mentioned, I gave a talk at DjangoCon about
a keynote, AI. To be fair.
A keynote. Yeah.
Yep.
And was a little nervous because it's like AI, not everyone loves it, but definitely I would say in my own work, I tend to use AI quite a lot. Right now, I would say the primary way that I'm using AI in two different ways. So I think with developer advocacy, I'm doing a lot of writing, for example. And so typically what I'll do is I'll have, you know, if there's a topic that I'm supposed to write about, I'll have AI go and get all of the documents, or I'll paste in some documents and then have it summarize the documents to me. And then I'll like use that as a starting point for a draft blog or something like that. Another thing is that I'm writing a lot of code. So right now, for example, I'm maintaining the Azure integrations in LangChain, and I'm doing a bunch of Python code for that. And I don't yet feel comfortable having AI like write a full PR for me to merge into those libraries. But what I do have AI do is for example, run linting for me. So I don't know why whenever I do linting, there's always like something that tends to be missed. So I have something where it just automatically runs the linting for me, which I think is quite nice. And I also have it sometimes if I'm having trouble with a bug, have it figure out where in the code the bug is. And then I use that to, as a starting point as well to debug. So yeah, those are the primary ways I would say I'm using. I'm using VS Code and Copilot, by the way. That's a plug for Microsoft.
That's fair.
But yeah, that's what I'm doing.
And Tim, what about you?
I too am using VS Code with Copilot pretty much every day. Like I said, you know, I'm really lucky I get to work on solving some really interesting problems. So I still write a fair amount of code, but I've found as I become a more and more senior engineer, I'm the first principal engineer in the history of the university. So this sort of new career path was sort of developed with me in mind, which was, you know, a really big honor. But I find the actual time I'm pressing buttons, writing code, is getting to be less and less. And these days, I also find that my best PRs often delete more code than they create. And I like to say, you know, while the LLM is very useful for those, you know, the 10 to 15% of the time I'm actually pushing buttons in the IDE, the most value my employer actually gets from me isn't Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. It's when I'm doing two things. One, sleeping, and two, showering. Because that's where I come up with the solutions to the really hard problems I work on. You know, there's sometimes I wake up in the morning and I've been staring at the screen for 3 days trying to solve a problem and I wake up and it's just there. Or I get out of the shower and the solution to that bug is just there. Another part of my job that I really enjoy on my day-to-day activities is working on projects with junior engineers. And sometimes an LLM can be involved in moving that along. So, you know, when you're pairing up with somebody, you're not sitting there, you know, one person isn't sitting there for 15 minutes while the other person is looking through the documentation, trying to find that thing you know is there somewhere, but you can't quite find it because every documentation setup is slightly different. So, I mean, that's another thing. Teaching is something that I found is still always fulfilling, that I never get bored of. So, you know, having an LLM integrated in that does make it a bit more efficient, but I don't think it's any kind of magic wand for my day-to-day activities. And yeah, that's sort of a summary of how it's, you know, it's another tool in my toolbox.
Carlton, are you willing to say publicly? I mean, I know you play with everything.
Yeah, no, I give all these things a go. My usage is very much what I call the Stack Overflow use case, where I found last year or so where I would previously have gone to Stack Overflow, I'm happy to type it into Claude or type it into Copilot, and the answers are, for me, about as good. They're sort of like, yeah, okay. And probably better than Stack Overflow, because otherwise it wouldn't have replaced them, in that I don't have to spend quite so long reading the number of threads. I get a concise, good answer straight away. And so for me, that's super. What I'm not doing with them is writing code. I might, you know, ask for an explanation. How does this work in JavaScript? Or how does this work in Playwright? And it'll tell me. And then, okay, I'm still going to write the code myself, though.
So not even autocomplete, tabbing autocomplete? No.
God, no. What do I use for autocomplete? I still use what's it called? LSP-based autocompletion, which is deterministic and correct. And perfect for me, in fact. Like the next line suggestion stuff that comes up, I'm like, I don't want that. I literally don't want that. As well, here's something you've got to remember. I have snippets for every code construction. So if I'm writing a loop, I have a snippet for the loop with placeholders that I tab between and things like that. I'm never typing for variable name in loop name. You know, I'm tabbing between the placeholders very rapidly. But that's totally pre-LLM. It's totally static. It's, you know, so the use case for autocomplete just doesn't come up for me in my use.
Go ahead.
No, you go, Tim.
I was just going to say, I found that the LLM autocomplete really gets in the way. You know, for years, people have talked about getting into flow as a programmer and hitting that flow state. And I found that when the LLM sort of interjects itself, it's jarring, it gets in the way, it gets in it gets in the way of my thought process. So I like having the chat agent on the side, but for the autocomplete or the think ahead type stuff it tries to do, I just find that really impedes my progress and, breaks chain of thought.
I've been thinking a lot about, the hype and like, where does this actually sit? I mean, and I think we're all sort of coalescing around, and this is one thing that came out of DjangoCon US, is it's a tool. It's a tool that has benefits. I don't think anyone feels like we're immediately going to be replaced. And it's imperfect for sure. But also, I was thinking, the old days of Stack Overflow and hunting around for a Google blog post and just being stuck. It's not that was perfect either. I guess like the three of you, I use it a lot for discovery, for research. I also find the autocomplete aggressive and also just annoying. But I'm using, the chat interface all the time for research or to like hunt down a bug. And increasingly I'm using agents on the command line, but more for boilerplate greenfield stuff. And still I still don't fully sit back. And even when I sit back, it's almost like I sort of miss the days of like fully doing compiled code. But when you sit there and just like it's whirring away, like what is that feeling? Like I just get like existential waiting 3 seconds, 20 seconds, and then I have to evaluate. Like I'd like to be a little more leaning in. So for myself, it's much more of like a research tool. That's a great research tool. But the fully agentic, spinning up 6 parallel agents and, having a coffee and coming back and it's done. I've never quite had that.
Sorry, Molly, I just have to ask, is that not the management thing that you would, Tim was just saying,
when you're going up to management in competence levels.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, I've far passed my incompetence levels, but yeah, the thing I've come back to is, we're all in the Python space. So if you're doing Python stuff and Django stuff, you get almost as good a result as you're going to get because Python and Django are so mature, so well documented, right? If you're using a newer programming language or a smaller programming language or framework, it doesn't work anywhere as well. So like this is tip of the spear, what we're all doing. And even then, on the one hand, I'm like, it's like, I still have to code, but it's also this amazing research discovery thing and finding bugs. I mean, I remember spending hours, if not days, on some little thing that I couldn't find the right post. And now the LLM, even if it doesn't get it right away, it'll, I mean, like, try harder, and it'll try harder and find stuff, right? It just feels like a speeding up of that, but not a total replacement of code. And yeah, and I still like elegant code. These things don't write elegant code. Even if you have rules or guidelines, like, it's incredibly verbose and, it just vomits up code rather than, like, concise code. I've even tried, write it in the style of, Carlton Gibson, like, go crawl his GitHub repos and, that helps a little bit, but it's still not a total replacement for you, Carlton.
What, no tests and sort of barely working on happy?
Cowboy coding. Cowboy coding, right? You put your cowboy hat on when you code, Carlton.
Go on, Marlene. Something... I can see you by chumping at a bit there. Go on.
Yeah, I wanted to say that it's so interesting that all three of you don't like the autocompletes because one of the things, Copilot and the VS Code team have been working on is just growing and meeting the demand for AI programming with Copilot and VS Code. And so I've been kind of looking at the comments on VS Code's social medias and things like that. And one of the number one complaints people have on social media is that they just feel like the autocomplete is not fast enough, or it's not like a lot of people compare it to Cursor and say that they think that, in VS Code, it's too slow or it's not doing enough, and they just want to tab, sort of is the vibe. And so it's so interesting to me that actually all three of you think that the autocomplete is usually too aggressive, or it's there's too much going on there. And I think it also shows kind of there's like a bit of a discrepancy in terms of like people's comfort levels with this, in terms of I think certain groups are like pushing the boundaries and want to be like really at the edge there. And even Will, you mentioned not wanting to leave agents. And I was talking to Armin, who's like the creator of Flask, and he was like, his
90%,
primary thing,
right?
if he does 90%, he lets Claude Code just write all of the code. He just wants to give it instructions and let it do its own thing and come back. And he's a great programmer. And then on the other hand, you know, I also, for example, even when I was first getting started with the autocomplete, felt like it was too aggressive. But over time, I think I just started to get used to it and that kind of wore off. So I'm now kind of using it quite a lot. But yeah, I think the discrepancy there sometimes is so interesting to me and kind of different.
Well, in Armin, I think just specifically on Armin, he's written some posts on how he used it. Like he has a custom something or other for YOLO mode where he just like lets it, you know. So he's spent a lot of time to fine tune this. And I think I think that's part of it, is not just playing around, but fine tuning it. Because if you just try to one shot something, of course it's going to be, I mean, this is the main thing I have when people say like, oh, it didn't work, whatever tool they're using, Junie, Claude, you know, Copilot. It's like, if you just ask it a simple one sentence prompt, how could you get something good, right? It's like the joke is like, you kind of have to use it to write a spec. You'd never write a spec for a fellow human, right, Tim and your team. Yeah. But if the machine will do it for you, you'll write the spec. So I do feel like you need to kind of like play with it more and to get to a point where you can fully evaluate it. But that said, I still am shocked that people, and there are some like Armin, who knows how to write code, is fully comfortable and happy and sped up. You know, doing that. So yeah, it makes me feel like, what's going on?
What's happening?
Where's the...
so much time reviewing code from running a successful project that
maybe he's used to that.
Doing the LLM code, because I think this verbosity issue is a pretty big issue. You know, I still prefer chat mode to agent mode. Agent mode feels far too much like autopilot to me. And when I've gone down that rabbit hole, I've ended up with sort of a maelstrom of nonsense a couple times. And, you know, studies have started to show that if you use LLMs too extensively, it does add a lot of technical debt. So I haven't owned a car in a dozen years. I just recently bought one. And the state of software on cars is absolutely miserable. CarPlay is actually an improvement, but the actual code and the individual components of a vehicle, the average vehicle has more than four times as much code as Facebook in it, which is terrifying. Because for me, every line of code I write, I consider a liability. Every line of code that I put out is a potential security flaw. So when I purchased my new car, I actually did research on what vehicle I could buy that had the least lines of code. And I ended up with a 2022 Toyota Corolla with only one screen. It doesn't have blinking lights all over the place. It doesn't have sensors all over the place. There was an interesting study that came out of Ford. Ford has 150 different software vendors that write the software together for their vehicles that they try to put together into one working package. And of course, car repairs for software are just as common as car repairs for anything that's actually wrong with the engine now. So, you know, this, I use this as an example of verbosity of code and runaway code bases that just become unmaintainable. And I think we're going to see this problem continue to grow over the years. You know, we're starting to see people whose actual job is fixing your LLM coded mess. Like, are marketing themselves as, I will come in and fix your vibe coded nonsense.
And they'll probably use an LLM to do it, though.
They likely will.
I mean, and again, you know, friend of the show, Jeff Triplett at RevSys, he's in the Armin Ronecker camp. Like he's figured out how to make it work. And I think it's a combination of knowing, of being used to your point, Tim, of being used to reviewing PRs. So you're kind of in that manager, whatever, higher level mindset anyways. But it's not a paradigm shift, but it's a shift to go from just evaluating someone else's thoughts to like thinking the thoughts yourself and then writing them. Yeah, I'm trying not to be all calcified about it, right? Like I use the chat and the research every day for 2 years, but the agents, and I still play with it and I'll use it for like fun projects and it mostly works, but then I just get, you know, then the debt builds up or I've lost control of a mental model of what's happening. And, you know, but it's weird because you can, you can, you know, we anthropomorphize these models, right? You can sort of treat it like a person, right? Like it'll do something and then say like, are you sure? Be like, okay, imagine that like, I don't trust you. Like you can do all these sort of tricks. And it doesn't seem like they should work, but they do kind of work, right? To be like, you know, how sure are you, you know? And they're getting better about being a little less syncophatic, but they're still, you know, they're not to your point, Tim, they're not going to like take out code as much, right? They're more like they want to generate stuff for you.
Hacksoft is your development partner beyond code. From custom software development to consulting, team augmentation, or opening an office in Bulgaria, they're ready to take your project to the next level.
We need deletional AI.
We need to delete. I mean, I think this is the thing. And this is one of the things that I mentioned as well in my talk is that I think the best way to, I agree completely that the technical debt thing is a thing. And I think more people are struggling with their code they have vibe coded and not knowing what to do with that. And I really do think that's a real issue. My thoughts there, or what has worked for me when I'm using like agent mode to help me with coding tasks, is I really use it in a modular way. So I don't have it generate, unless it's something like completely greenfield where it's like a prototype or something like that, or I, you know, it's just creating the structure of it or something. Usually what I will do is I'll give it one file and I'll say, this is the issue with this file. I want XYZ done in this file. Or I see this bug in this file. Here's all of this context. And if you treat it in a modular way, where you know exactly what the goal is for this problem and you give it all the context that it needs, I actually think it can be super helpful in those cases when it's a modular case. When you're just generating these larger, bigger projects and just having it go off, I would say those are a little bit harder to control. And that's where I think the technical debt comes in. But I think there's other ways to use it. I primarily use agent mode, and I found that for me, agent mode is better because the model usually has access to the logs and things like that, and the whole structure a bit better when it's in agent mode. But I will restrict it and say, even though you have all of this, only, you know, write code, change this file or do things like that. So giving it restrictions.
Do you have that in your rules, or do you have to manually put that in each time?
I do sometimes add it to my rules, but usually I will put it in the chat. So usually I will give it the context that it needs, and I found that works for me because I'm not usually trying to refactor the entire code base, at least not in the problems that I'm working on. For me, it's usually adding a feature or debugging an issue one at a time. And so that's where I would use it. But
wondering how much of a productivity boost this really is, or if it's just a different way of attacking problems. You know, I started to think about what are the biggest productivity boosts. So I started writing code when I was 6 years old. So I've been writing code for a long time. I was trying to think of what are the biggest productivity boosts I've seen as a developer over, you know, over four decades. And, you know, Stack Overflow sort of coming about in the 2000s and 2010s was definitely a big boost to my productivity. Having sort of the amalgamation, the coming together of all the development knowledge on a single source that I could rely on was. But I think the biggest productivity boost I ever got as a developer was Windows 98. Yes, Windows 98 was the first time I had an operating system that had support for a second monitor.
You okay?
That was truly a game changer for my development productivity. Let me tell you, having like browser and Emacs up at the same time, I'm dating myself, but that was a game changer.
the thought that comes up with Will's example when you get stuck on something for hours. And I think the thing that these tools are amazing for is, you know, if I remember when I was learning, got stuck, I'm missing a semicolon or something, and I'm at home by myself and I had nobody to help me, and I couldn't work it out. And eventually I worked out, but it was the hours of like tearing my hair out about this stupid semicolon. Whereas one of these machines would have spotted that and told me and gone, look, this isn't working. Why isn't this working? It's not working because. And that would have been an amazing boost. And I think, you know, again, Stack Overflow, a lot of people learned by copying and pasting from Stack Overflow. And there was all this kind of programmer superiority about, oh, you mustn't copy and paste from Stack Overflow. But a whole generation of people learned by copying and pasting from Stack Overflow. Well, nothing wrong with that. That's brilliant. More power to them. And I think the same here from LLMs. I think if you're a junior by yourself, you haven't, you know, who hasn't got a support there, who a mentor there who can brainstorm it with you, to have the LLM go, you know, here's the problem, that's going to let you go forward faster. I think for me, that use case is very interesting. We can open up an awful lot of doors with these, I don't know, what are they? You have magic lanterns that speak, you know, speak kind of the truth.
Well, it calls. It may be, Carlton, you and I are the self-taught, non-formally trained ones in this discussion. So yeah, like days on a semicolon, and maybe newer IDEs would fix it. But that feeling of just helplessness, like that's gone. I think
JavaScript today, you know, I'm like, you know, why aren't my keys for my object being right? Oh, because they're key literal keys and you need an evaluated key. Brilliant. Oh, thank you, Java. Thank you, LLM, for solving my problems.
Yeah.
It's not just about being beginners.
But how much of what we learn as programmers, as software engineers, comes during those 3 hours you are hunting for that stuff. I mean, that feeling I used to get when I was writing, you know, Turbo Pascal, there was no internet, and I was there with my own devices and a book of Borland Turbo Pascal. When I found that semicolon after 3 hours, I'd learned a lot more about my code base. I'd learned a lot more general knowledge from going through the book and learning about, you know, how you should write code and how to avoid these problems in the future. I'd learned a lot about debugging, and the feeling of accomplishment you get after struggling like that. Sheena O'Connell said something brilliant at last year's DjangoCon when she was teaching people during the tutorial during sprints, and that was, never steal someone's struggles from them, because that is the best way that people learn and how they come to love programming, is that feeling of accomplishment after the struggle. That journey is an important part of becoming a senior software engineer. And I think that part of that is being taken away from a generation of people, and part that I truly love. Love and hate.
I just want to jump in there, because the flip side of that as well is that the real reason why I don't use the agents more is, you know, quality of output and all these things. I can say all that. The real reason why is I'm worried about losing my strength. I'm worried about going to the gym and getting the machine to do the weights for me. And, you know, what happens in 6 months' time when I haven't really been coding the same way? Have I still got the same strength? So that's the flip side of the hard learning, is by doing the reps every day coding, you keep your skills sharp.
And what happens in 6 years' time when our entire industry has lost those muscles? Are we in a situation where the entire developer industry is something like trying to find COBOL programmers now?
Yeah. I actually would agree with that. And if I'm being honest, I think that's my primary concern about LLMs in AI. My primary concern is for junior developers and building that muscle. And I actually it's so interesting, because I had a conversation, I was reading something recently where there's been some studies done about how LLMs tend to select for, or it's biased towards, senior engineers, where even, we talked about Amin earlier, and even the intuition needed to review what the agent has done, etc., to know what to change, what not to change, is something that is biased towards senior engineers that already have the experience. Mm-hmm. And so if junior engineers don't have that struggle that Tim is talking about to be able to understand their code, how do they actually get to the point where they know how to interact even there with an LLM in a way that's productive? I think that's actually an industry level concern that I think we need to be worried about as an industry. How do we actually solve that problem? I do think that there needs to be some spaces where there's a joint collaboration. So I think LLMs can be good, like Carlton said, for potentially like personalizing education and helping to make it easier to ask questions. So maybe if a junior developer doesn't know how to solve a specific task, and maybe you give them room to struggle. So I think we need to be rethinking, how do we use what we have, these tools, to be able to create these environments where the junior engineers can still grow, can still learn, but we are preparing them for the future that is inevitably coming with the LLMs in general. So I would say here on this point, I agree. It's something I'm concerned about. And I think we need to be thinking about this.
I just had an idea as you were talking there. I think if the chat UI had like a kind of timer where you had to spend 10 minutes writing the prompt, right? So if you spent 10 actual minutes writing the prompt, then you can press enter and send it to the LLM. But if you haven't done that, then you have to spend the 10 minutes, because that makes you think it through. That's like a rubber
duck. Yeah, 100%.
Well, one thing I think about...
I wrote that as a demo.
Yeah, we need to do that.
I mean, on the education point, though, we're replacing experts with ghosts, right? These LLMs are kind of ghosts of, like, where did the stuff come from? And, you know, not everyone has access to, you know, ping Carlton when they're stuck on a bug, but it is, I don't know if it's magic or what it is. Like, I was just watching Andres Karpathy just had a long interview on, was it Darkesh Patel's vodcast, and some really interesting takeaways. And he was saying something I've thought about. Like, he's like, the internet is such garbage. Like, it's not, you know, it's not New York Times articles. Like, it's just complete garbage. There's no, doesn't make any sense how something can come out of this garbage. And so on the one hand, like, what's left there that has any like good meaning. So Stack Overflow, let's take that as an example, right? So you ask a question and then humans come in and give responses and vote up or down. There's no, and it's not perfect, but it's pretty good. Like, there's nothing like that with these LLMs, and yet somehow they sort of kind of do it, but like, you can't trust it. And also, why would any of us go on Stack Overflow now and try to get credibility or write an issue, do a good response, write a book? You know, like, the new Django survey will be out by the time this comes out. You know, people aren't reading books. They're not even reading blog posts. You know, like, look at like Adam Johnson. If you just read Adam Johnson blog posts, you would be like a senior dev. But, you know, he's just doing it because he wants to, right? Like, there's no,
Your point on Stack Overflow is incredible, because we might be at peak LLM coding time right now. Because the top model is now a ghost town. Like, Stack Overflow is dead.
Yeah, it's probably 3 years ago, the training set.
I mean, if you look at the number of questions tagged Django or tagged Python over the past 5 years, it's dropped off a cliff, and there is nobody on Stack Overflow. I used to get, you know, 30 points a day for my various responses out there.
Yeah.
I now get, you know, 30 points a month or something like that for upvotes to my old responses. What happens if things change and there's no central model for the LLMs to steal their training from? I'm looking at right now, all of these LLMs are being operated at a big loss. So
here we go.
I made $4 billion last year and spent $9 billion to make that $4 billion. This is not sustainable, and it's not going to last forever. And, you know, I referenced AI a bit in my talk. a lot of my senior thesis written in the mid-1990s was about the dream of AI. I am not a hater, but I've been around enough hype cycles, and I've seen what these big tech companies have done to the internet and done to search engines and shitifying their own products, that I truly think, you know, the same patterns that social media and big tech have brought us over the past few decades are sort of being repeated on steroids. And they have not yet enshittified the LLM. What happens when they want to keep you on the LLM longer, like Google has, and starts intentionally giving you worse results? Some of the worst companies and the worst people in the world are the ones pulling these levers while genuflecting to the current U.S. administration. This is worrisome to me. Yeah. I can see the same exact pattern of what has happened to Google, to search engines, to social media, to them lobbying and not having any concerns for our children's mental health or futures, being amped up on steroids. And I see the same sort of people. I see Sam Altman and I see Mark Zuckerberg. You know, I don't see much of a difference in the morals or the discussions coming out of them. I see move fast and break things. I see little concern for the mental health of people, for humanity or the future, and that worries me. Yeah. So I think we're currently at the peak of performance we're going to see, because the companies are going to start intentionally enshittifying them to put profit over pulling people in. Because that's a pattern we've seen over and over and over over the past couple of decades.
Well, sorry, Marlene, you go.
I definitely agree to an extent that I do think that I think currently the way the world is structured is to maximize profit in a lot of ways. And I don't think, you know, LLMs are an exception to that. I do think LLMs are not explored enough in terms of the good potential that could come out of them. Do I think there's loads of bad things that are going to come out of them? Yes. I think we are seeing that already now. I'm not sure if you saw Sam Altman shared some updates recently that are concerning, that I think as well, the intention is to continue to keep people using ChatGPT, for example. And you can look for that online. I won't talk about it. But I think that I also think that technology is always going to be this sort of double-edged sword where you have very good things and very bad things coming out of it. So, you know, when I was at DjangoCon, I talked about how we haven't really explored to the extent that we could these open source models, these small language models that have huge potential to transform education. I talked about the Django Girls curriculum and how we could do something like Django Girls offline, because there's so many parts in Africa, for example, that are being left behind. And there's this growing digital divide that is consistently growing and no one is doing anything about it. And it's not changing. And like, people just don't have the resources there to bridge that gap. And the thing that has helped to sort of close this gap over time, technology is a huge part of that. So, you know, I grew up in Zimbabwe, and a big part of why I learned how to code in Python is because I had access to an internet cafe where I could go and I could connect with people online who are like writing Django code and who can teach me stuff. And that's because of technology. And those advances, yes, can absolutely have huge ramifications, negative ramifications. But also, you know, I think about the parts in Zimbabwe, for example, that don't have access to stable internet connection, or internet is super expensive. And thinking to myself, can I imagine a world where we bring in small language models that can teach people when they don't have an internet connection? And what that means if someone now has access to all this information is huge. So my personal perspective on this is there are two parts that are going to continue to grow, which is very negative stuff, and then also potentially very positive. So that's my perspective. I would agree to an extent, but also don't want to forget the other side as well.
Yeah, and that's a really good way of looking at it, Marlene. I think I, you know, really positive. The thought that came up so I saw a similar article to you, Tim, was about the economics of all this and the sort of latest, whether it's latest or recent figures. They're spending $3 to get one. Well, that's not, you know, $3 of spending to make one in revenue. Well, that's not sustainable. And it seems like nobody's going to pay three times as much for the same service, because you can run a local model, which I've got a 5-year-old laptop that runs a model that I can do 90% of what I do with the Claudes and the ChatGPTs or the Copilots of the world. It seems those local models might be, you know, the way forward. If you can, you know, there's an internet in a box project, which I think is, you know, has, you download Wikipedia, you download your PyPI mirror, you've got everything you need to run workshops without an internet connection. If they had a local LLM on them as well, then you've got the complete set. I wonder what you think about local models and, you know, how that affects the economics of these frontier, the Anthropics and the open eyes of the world.
Well, I think, when we look at things like agent skills and MCPs right now, people are spending a lot of time making these attempts to plug these sort of answer anything God machines into our local systems. And I remember Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. They build the computer Deep Thought to find the answer to life, the universe, and everything, the ultimate question of the universe. And it comes back with the answer being 42. But what use is really is there in that? And I think you're really onto something, because it's been shown, you know, studies have started to come out that show that the smaller the scope, the higher the accuracy and utility of a language model. And, I could be completely wrong, but I think the far more useful future that you're speaking about here could be small, focused, tightly scoped language models. Not just RAG, but the entire language model being contained to a very specific scope. I mean, imagine if our coding LLMs didn't have billions of unused parameter pathways for when someone wanted to make a cat picture, but was just focused really on, you know, the Stack Overflow training set. You know, it would be a lot more efficient. It would be a lot more environmentally friendly to run. It could run locally. Maybe dividing these things up, having 1,000 different models instead of one big God machine, is the way to go, because then it also can be run locally. You know, maybe the race shouldn't be to 1 trillion parameters. Maybe it should be to 1 million parameters. It's going to be interesting to see.
I think those are called focal models. That's, you know, small focused. That's the term I've seen bandied around. But Carlton, I do want to, can we mention the comment you shared with me yesterday about the art heist at the Louvre? Carlton shared a meme or something going around saying, you know, if the thieves had said they were training a LLM model, it would have been fine to go take off with the jewels. Because there is, I keep coming back to the underlying there, like how, even if the technology keeps improving, how could it have good responses if the underlying content is garbage? And as all the economic underpinnings for creating good content on Stack Overflow, on a book, on a blog post, even something as prosaic as like, I'm going hiking, I want to buy a backpack. In the old web, you know, you could try to rank for like top backpacks and do a ton of research and have affiliate links. And that would justify hours and hours of time to do well. Well, why would you do that now, right? Especially as, like Tim, you were mentioning, all these LLMs are now going to be adding in, you know, e-commerce, ads, right? Like I do sort of wonder if this is the glory days of, you know, if this is like Google in, you know, 2000 or something, right? Because they're actually trying to give you the right response. But because of the underlying economics, we know that they're going to be doing the things you alluded to, Marlene, like they're going to be turning it in, they're going to be inshittifying it. And it's going to be about engagement. 1000%, right? Like there's that another meme is the connector core, like the power adapter plugged into itself. Like that does seem to be accurate. But Marlene, you seem like you had something to add.
I think it's so tricky, because I'm going to I'm going to play devil's advocate, I guess, for a little bit. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think it's hard because at the same time, there's definitely opposing views in the space in terms of, like, on one hand as well, we need to kind of be thinking about the future and how do we get to the best possible technology we can create for the future. And I think the issue is that the frontier labs are at least framing themselves as having the solution to get to that future. So a lot of people have talked about AGI. That's a big thing people are hoping we get to. And so, when we look at OpenAI, for example, they were the pioneers for ChatGPT. They've been the ones that have been pushing the frontier. You know, Anthropic has now come on the scene and is also pushing the frontier there with LLMs. And we've seen that scaling these LLMs has helped to an extent. And if the people who have the most knowledge at the moment, we're assuming the people that have the most knowledge about this space are working for, you know, these frontier labs, do they not kind of owe it to us to kind of explore to the full extent how good these LLMs can get so that potentially, maybe the LLMs could generate really good results on their own? And I know there's a lot of talk right now on reinforcement learning and having these LLMs learn by themselves and improve themselves over time. I don't know if that's a practical future. Do we think that this is a practical future, that that's something that is actually going to happen? Or do we think this is all going to be driven by economic incentives and there's no incentive almost at all to reach this kind of AGI future is my question.
I referenced in my DjangoCon talk this year, the one I gave 2 years ago, which blew up beyond my expectations on YouTube and got, I guess it struck a chord. It got a lot of views, whereas imploring people not to buy into the AI hype. You know, some people took that to think that, you know, I was a technology hater or something like that. It's quite the opposite. You know, the thesis of that talk was meant to be that this insane hype cycle, which is the biggest technology hype cycle I've seen in my over four decades in tech, is actively preventing us from finding how to use these algorithms to improve the human condition. Because I do think there is a there. There's an undeniable something there in these algorithmic advances we've made over the past few decades. You know, we see it in better prediction models and tracking hurricanes and stuff like that. But, you know, trying to make these into some kind of magic wand, I think is actively dangerous. I think I've watched OpenAI go from being supposedly a nonprofit that was supposed to improve the future to humanity to now, you know, creating interactive sex bots that I think Marlene was referring
to. That's true.
Last week. It's like, how do you go?
Trying to keep it PG on the Django chat.
Yeah. Well, Tim, to be fair, if you read like Empire of AI and other stuff, they never really meant it. They just couldn't, they didn't have the salaries to compete with Google. And so what better way than to say we're an academic lab? So I don't think they ever meant it. I mean, there's internal chats like a week in with between Musk and all the rest saying, well, as soon as we hit scale, we can just discard this.
Oh my gosh.
During college, he's never been a straight shooter.
Yeah. We've had the discussion. Yeah.
Yes. I just, since you mentioned the interactive sex bots or whatever it is, I saw a good comment about that the other day, which was that if I really thought I was 18 months away from AGI, I wouldn't be pivoting to interactive sex bots, right?
Yeah.
I think that's the answer to Marlene's question, is they don't think they're anywhere close.
The hidden truth is there.
Yeah. If I could switch gears slightly, because we're coming a little bit on time, I did want to ask a question around how can Django be if not an AI-first framework, not miss out on this wave that Fast API is riding? Carlton and I have discussed this. I'm curious, Tim and Marlene, if either of you have thoughts on right? I mean, fast API is completely ascendant for a number of reasons. Yeah. And how does Django latch onto that and not be left behind?
Well, I think in my opinion,
the big question.
That's a great question. I mean, in my opinion, I do think that as a community in the Django community, we just need to be, I think, more open to AI. Do I think AI has some very toxic things potentially associated with it? Yes, absolutely. But at the same time, I think there's lots of good that we can add, that AI adds. And so, you know, I mentioned potentially a lot of Django just generally as it's structured is fantastic for doing modular programming, for example, and helping people who are vibe coding applications. Django's a potentially really good framework for that. And I think doing things to actively like interact with that AI community is something that I think can grow the Django ecosystem in terms of AI. So I mentioned creating potentially an agents.md file that people can go ahead and put in their code and have Copilot or whatever Juni, whichever assistant they want to use, be able to create a Django app for them, but that's following the guidelines that this agents.md file creates. So really creating these centralized resources that we're also using to kind of steward where we want the industry to be going. And even as Django developers, I think these conversations we're having right now are really helpful. So, you know, how helping Django developers have some guidance in terms of how they should use AI or how we think we should be approaching the community. And I forget, why am I forgetting his name? Corey is fantastic. And he has a really good video he made on vibe coding with Django that I think has like some fantastic principles on approaching it, you know, in terms of modularity and things like that. So more resources about AI and Django is what I would personally love to see. Yeah.
So Wagtail Space was about a week and a half ago on October 9th and 10th, and the videos are now available. And on the second day, Sage Abdullah and Tom Usher, two of the core team, gave a really good talk about how Wagtail is going to handle AI in the future. And I really like the path that Wagtail is going down. You know, so many of the corporate entities out there are forcing AI into all of their products, forcing it down our throats, raising prices after initially giving it for free. You know, we've seen it over and over and over again with Microsoft putting Copilot everywhere. There are like 18,000 different versions of Copilot coming from every angle. No offense, Marlene, I know it's...
That's true.
Salesforce is doing the same. You know, all of the big tech companies are making it sort of mandatory. They're not giving people an opt-in option. Wagtail is taking the opposite approach. Wagtail has made a commitment that there will never be any AI forced to the Wagtail core, but that the Wagtail team is making a secondary package for anybody who is interested and wants to opt into it called Wagtail AI. So you can pip install Wagtail if you just want the core Wagtail AI free, but if you want some of the AI features, you can pip install Wagtail AI. So the talk given during Wagtail Space, I think it's available on YouTube now, is called AI and Wagtail, Responsible Innovation for Content Editors. And a couple of the commitments Wagtail has made is, again, that it won't ever be forced into core, but this is a blessed under the Wagtail organization's umbrella package that is being developed secondarily to Wagtail for people who want those AI features. It also said, We'll provide a clear picture of our AI vision, have it publicly stated, and we will always avoid any kind of vendor lock-in. It also gives sort of a practical knowledge of what's available today in the Wagtail AI in this talk. So it's something that people can look at right now. I think that's a pretty good model. So, you know, I consider myself incredibly lucky. We've had Django code in production for a decade now. I've also been sober for a decade now. So it's caused me to sort of reflect on how lucky I am to be part of these amazing communities, my recovery community, my work colleagues, and then the Russian doll of Wagtail within Django, within Python. You know, I've met some of the most amazing people of my life through these communities. And I think that having the right people in place here to have this sort of moral and ethical conversation about the right ways to do it, to allow people to opt in without forcing it down our throats. I think Wagtail is really sort of leading the way here. And as being sort of the smaller Russian doll within Django and Python, I think it's a good place where we can look where on a slightly smaller scale than Django or a much smaller scale than Python, maybe Wagtail is sort of leading the way in something we can look to as Django on a way to sort of address it head on. But without being the first ones to dip our toe in the pool, it might be somewhat easier to do when you're in the content management space than a bigger web framework space. But I think there's some really good ideas there.
Yeah.
I would just add my talk was related to this idea of, I think there's a sense that Django and FastAPI just on the underlying technologies is an either or, when practically speaking, it's both. You can and probably should use both. And I see a whole new generation of Python developers starting with machine learning and pure Python, and then FastAPI comes along and it's an endpoint and they think that's the end of the web. And so I see a gap there, an education gap around, you know, when does Django slide in? Because people think, well, do I even need Django? And part of that is just if you read, you know, Reddit or Hacker News, you only see posts from OpenAI or Anthropic. You see massive scale as opposed to, nope, me, couple of people trying to incorporate LLMs into a workflow. And then Django's there. But I think we in the Django community need to tell that story a little bit better. One of the things in my talk was showing how you can hook Django into a local LLM and have a chatbot, because like it works, you know, it works pretty fast actually too, you know, so like we're not running our own frontier models here. So yeah, FastAPI has its uses and for sure, but like just clarifying, like I'd love to give a talk next year on kind of choose your own web framework, you know, like choose your own adventure and just break down like Flask is great here, FastAPI is great here, Django is great here, and just sort of, I guess, redefine what those boundaries are, because I think it's still a little fuzzy, especially to a newcomer. You know, it used to be Flask versus Django, and now it's really FastAPI and like, do I even need Django? You know, so that's something
I've really enjoyed over the past couple of months on a project I'm working on is Django Ninja. Sort of the same feeling of FastAPI, but I've got those nice, comfortable batteries that I'm familiar with of Django and the Django ORM. So I've got all like my webby stuff, but then it gives me sort of that FastAPI, you know, quick, easy API access, ultimately flexible. So Django Ninja has been one of the tools I've really enjoyed working with sort of in the LLM space, tying it into Django.
And Carlton, you have some Skunkworks projects around APIs that maybe shall remain hidden now?
No, so I'm targeting end of year to have the proof of concept out for a take on serialization, which is new, modern serialization that is sort of ORM friendly, because, you know, it's... You know, the bottom line is for me that REST framework serializers are kind of the last generation, and they're a lot slower than Katters or Pydantic or Message Spec. And, you know, there's a whole raft of these newer ones, which are just much, 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 much quicker. But they don't know anything about the Django ORM. And I think there's a nice way where we can, you know, handle restricted field queries, automatic prefetch related, and have modern serialization and the speed effects from there. So I'm working on that. I'm hoping for end of year around that kind of period to have something to show.
Okay. Well, as we end the shows, we've started a habit of referencing a project, and if you have it, a book recommendation. Maybe I'll go first. We'll put a link to it. Marlene, you have a Django Girls offline repo that is excellent, fun to explore. Maybe the start of something more of having offline resources for places that don't have internet access. So that's the one I will call out and we'll link to.
Thank you.
Who's next?
I was going to say the Django Girls offline one. Okay.
You can't say one that you did. You can't say one that you did.
I can't say one I did. Okay.
Well, put your DjangoCon, your talk repo. You have the great tokenizer and the MCP.
Yeah, exactly,
like your demos were so good.
Okay, awesome. I'm not going to recommend one from me then. Maybe Tim go first so that I can think through which one to recommend.
So, I honestly don't read many technology books, but a couple that I've read, one of my favorite recent reads was by Carl Sagan's daughter, Sasha Sagan. It's called For Small Creatures Such as We, and it's a love letter to the universe on behalf of an atheist who has recently had a child, and how she seeks to create meaning in the universe through rituals without falling back on religion. And it's an absolutely wonderful book. It's, I needed something optimistic and uplifting given the state of the world, and it definitely hit the spot for that. So I will definitely recommend Sasha Sagan's For Small Creatures Such as We. And I also wanted to mention just two projects, Wagtail Nest and Django Commons, I think people are probably pretty familiar with. I've moved some of my projects over to Django Commons and Wagtail Nest, and I found them to be a huge help with avoiding developer burnout. Just having other people to pick up the slack during those months when you are doing something like, I don't know, planning a wedding and now have a 13-year-old in your life. It's been very handy. So if you're looking for a group to get together to avoid sort of that single developer on project burnout, both Wagtail Nest for the Wagtail community and Django Commons for Django projects has been absolutely wonderful.
I'm definitely going to check out that book there that you talked about, Tim. That sounds amazing for me. I wanted to mention a project, Django Keel by Sayum Kurana, who goes under the tagline on GitHub of Curious Learner. It's another kind of production-ready template for your Django projects. Sayum is top-notch. Really quality developer. I'm really keen to see what his opinions are and what options he's had. It looks like it goes into a lot more depth than most of your starter projects. He's got things about observability. He's got things about async versus background tasks. He's got front-end story, back-end story. He's got proper docs on read the docs. It looks really good. So I'm excited by that. That's Django.
Sayum is great. I also know that he is looking for work. So if anybody's looking to hire a top-notch developer, seek out Sayum on LinkedIn. He's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'll double that. I'll put my little tick on that as well. Yeah, if I didn't know he was looking for work, but yeah, just hire him if you're in the market for it. It's a great opportunity. For a book, I wanted to mention the Web Accessibility Cookbook. This is by Manuel Matuzovic, which is it's just a kind of how to. It goes through, like, I don't know, everything you need to know about your website. So you can create accessible HTML from the get-go rather than trying to bolt it on afterwards. Really, really, really solid learning in that book. I really recommend it. Anyway.
Okay, I'll just quickly do a book, and then Marlene, if you have your thoughts, you can go. So I've been reading Apple in China, which came out early this year. Tim, you'd love this one if you haven't read it. But it's, you know, basically how Apple thought it was, it moved tens of billions of dollars every year into China and really developed the infrastructure in China and thought it was getting the better end of the deal. And that turns out China was. So I think it's interesting, just day to day, the executives at Apple really did never step back and think, why is China being so accommodating? Why are they allowing us to do all these things? And, you know, Apple thinking short-term, China thinking long-term in a way. And the amount of investment Apple alone put into China just dwarfs any federal plans and everything else we have here. So I think it's really, really eye-opening, really kind of scary, but really well-researched. So I'd recommend that book. So Marlene, do you have something you want to add?
Yes. So I was trying to look for the repository. I can't find the name of the repository. But I mentioned Corey Zhu. And that when I was researching for my Django talk, I had been looking on the discussions page for on the Django project website. And I'd actually seen a conversation between Will and Corey where they were discussing an agents.md file for the Django project. I think Will had been like asking if there was one around or what people's thoughts on it were. And that's where Corey shared his YouTube video. And then I went off like on a tangent to watch the YouTube video. And anyway, in that YouTube video, Corey like talks about like principles for vibe coding. And then he also shares like a project that he created, a Django project he created through this vibe coding process. So I was going to recommend that. I cannot find the repo at the moment, but hopefully I will find it after and I will link that so that it can be linked somewhere for people to help. But a great person to follow, I would say, is Corey, has a YouTube channel with great thoughts there. And then for a book recommendation, I don't know. I'll kind of do like two half recommendations. The first is there's not a book, but it's Simon Willison's blog, which I think is really good if you want someone who's a realist, someone who's connected to Django, of course. I think he has fantastic thoughts about AI and generally where the industry is heading, and has very kind of realist perspectives there. But that's like not a book. A fun book, kind of fun to recommend for reading, is I've been reading a book called Children of God, and it's like a sci-fi book.
Is that fun though? That's a little bit apocalyptic.
It's a little apocalyptic. It's a little bit.
I mean, a little bit in a British sense.
Yeah,
right?
It is. It is not a fun book in the chill sense of the term, but it's so interesting because in the book, I've been surprised by, this is a book that was written a long time ago, and the author imagines AI.
This is Mary Doria Russell, right? So
exactly.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I love her. I've read this. I've read a ton of her stuff. She's so good. Sorry,
she's
go
so
ahead.
Good. And
all her stuff,
I remember reading this part where she was talking about AI in the book. For this, like, they are on an alien planet somewhere, and she's imagining what AI would, like, talking about what AI is like. And I was just like, I do not know how someone from back in the day could have this kind of foresight to imagine that it would be like this. So that book is called Children of God. It's a fiction book. Can recommend it.
I still remember because it's Father Sandoz. Linguist who speaks like 13 languages. And there's a line that still haunts me where he, I think it's communicating with the aliens. He has a line about, fluent in 13 languages, and he couldn't find the word to express a phrase or a feeling. And that utter frustration of language failing oneself.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you for mentioning her. She's so good. I think that's her best one. She's written a ton. She's done poetry too. Oh, deep cut. Yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah, really good book. Can recommend. Yeah, some cool pieces for sure about language and about AI as well. So
I think it's a testament again to Python and Django community that, you know, it's like recommend a book and only one out of the three was on tech.
Exactly. Carlton's pretty consistent, you know. Carlton's good.
I've realized it's my job to recommend
of life.
Yeah,
it's my job to recommend a tech book because everyone else always goes off left field. So I'm like, okay, I'll be the tech book person.
Yeah, 100%.
Well, as we wrap up, is there anything Tim or Marlene you wanted to mention that we didn't get a chance to cover?
I just wanted to tell anybody who's out there looking for work that I don't think AI is going to take all the jobs. I want to assuage that fear a bit. When you look at the history, whether it's farm work or, the computer being introduced in the 1980s, it eliminated 3.5 million jobs, but it created over 19 million jobs. So while some people were displaced, it ultimately led to more work. I remember 20 years ago, headlines saying, that half of the employment of the healthcare industry was going to be replaced by technology. And instead, over the next decade, it doubled. So I want to leave anybody who's struggling to look for work right now. I think that's got a lot more to do with sort of political forces right now and uncertainty than it does anything AI. Mark Benioff, CEO of Salesforce, has been gleefully been celebrating laying off 10,000 of his own employees. But they hired 20,000 people in 1 year during the pandemic. Is it more likely that he is actually using AI to replace these people right now? Or is it more likely he's covering up for a stupid hiring bitch that his company made? So if you're looking for work, I know it's tough. This is the worst job economy I've seen for tech in many years. I want to send out my sympathies to anybody who's looking for work right now. It's incredibly hard. But I also want to give a ray of hope that I don't think that AI is going to take all of the technology jobs in the future. And I think there will be hope and it will rebound. So I just wanted to send that out to anybody out there because I know it's tough.
Marlene, you don't have to, but if you had something you want to.
I think I would just, I agree with him that the market is really tough right now. And I would say that I do still think that the core skills matter. And, right now, for example, even at Microsoft, we had like loads of layoffs as well. Not great. But at the same time, there's like, I have no idea why I laughed when I was saying that because it's such a serious issue. I'm so sorry. But like, I think the issue is that we had like lots of layoffs, but at the same time, the company is hiring as well in a lot. And there's so many open positions right now. And a lot of those positions are kind of aligned to AI. So I would encourage people as well not to be afraid of AI. I think there's a lot of negative things that it's led to. But I think if we can combine the skills that we have right now with that knowledge, I do think that there are opportunities there for us. And I really hope that as an industry as well, we can just work together to hopefully shape the direction of where the industry is headed for the better. So yeah, that's what I will say.
Nice. I like that. Well, Tim and Marlene, thank you so much for coming on, for continuing this conversation. That's really kind of the point of this podcast is to do that, to have the conversations and to share them. So thank you for making the time.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
All right. And we are djangochat.com and we're also on YouTube and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
This episode was sponsored by Hacksoft, your Django development partner beyond code. Learn more about their services in the link in the description.